Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I am Norma Walden, chair of the club's International Relations Forum. Our speaker today, Julia Geist, is a docent lecturer with the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco, the De Young, and the Legion of Honor. Working with the Fine Arts Museum since 1979, she has been quite active as a docent for many shows, and also as a lecturer for docent training classes. Ms. Geist is now chair of the Docent Council. And among other positions in our Bay Area community, she served as board president of the Museum of Craft and Folk Art in San Francisco. Please welcome Julia Geist to tell us about the life and creations of haute couture designer Cristobal Balenciaga.
I love coming to this podium because I get to be 8 inches taller. It's marvelous. Well, I suspect you all know that there is an exhibition at the De Young Museum going on right now of Balenciaga in Spain. It's on till July 4th. And this lecture will certainly introduce you to the exhibition itself at the end of the lecture. But what I am interested in is his life, his career, and certainly the context for him. So I'd like to start with telling you all that the man was very well known during his lifetime. His lifetime is 1895 to 1972. If you ever want to know how old he was when he designed a certain garment, just add 5 to it because it's the 5 years that he was born in the 19th century. But what I really wanted to do initially by way of introduction is to remind us all where haute couture comes from. Balenciaga didn't start it. He certainly is the master of it. And in fact, among many of his contemporary designers, couturiers, he was called the couturier's couturier. He was the master of us all. That's a direct quote by Christian Dior. Just to show you, before I give you that history, just a couple of dresses, of garments that he designed. And I'm starting in 1939, although you will learn very quickly that he designed in Spain throughout the 20s and the 30s before he moved to Paris. But I personally can find no examples of those early garments. So the 40s, watch the silhouette with Balenciaga. Watch the silhouette with any couturier. After the war, moving into the 50s, and the mid-50s on your right. The tunic comes in. You see the waistline went away, didn't it? And it really went away. However, the evening gowns maintain waistlines throughout his career. They're sort of a different way of looking at clothes. The 60s, maybe some of us in here remember those years, that decade. The waistline, as you can see, is moving up and down, but it's not touching the body. Late 60s, it moves totally away. The gown on your right, by the way, is a wedding gown, the utmost in simplicity. In 67, we're going to talk about influences in this lecture. And the last collection of all, again, the wedding gown on the left. And since it is April 29th, how can I not mention the wedding that happened today? Her design was by the house of Stephen McQueen. He's dead. And the designer was Sandra, oh, I learned it and forgot it, Burton, Sandra Burton, who's working for them. And I will talk about that gown just briefly when I show you one of Balenciaga's later in the lecture. So here we go with the beginning of couturier history. Mid-19th century, Englishman moves to Paris, works for the people in power, that's Napoleon III, and designs these incredible gowns. And what he does that's different from dressmakers of the past is that he actually would make sketches, or he would have somebody do sketches for him. Then he would take them to the court, and the ladies would pick and choose, and then they would make the gowns. In other words, there weren't shows, fashion shows, as you and I know them today. Following is Paul Poiret at the very end of the 19th and first part of the 20th century, and you'll notice that he's loosening up what one has to wear underneath the gowns to make yourself fashionable and beautiful. And another thing I'd like for you all to notice and certainly think about during my lecture, the whole lecture today, Controversial question is fashion art. And one of the things you can start to think about is the classics. And my own personal observation is, would I wear it today or tonight? And the answer is yes on Mr. Poiré. But that's my personal observation, and you all certainly don't have to agree with it. Mariano Fortuny, my very favorite designer, was an Italian. And again, this reminds me of another show we're having at the Legion of Honor right this minute called Pulp Fashion, the paper fashions of Isabelle de Borchgrave, a Belgian who makes these fashions out of paper, folded and painted and printed paper. They are phenomenal. And she has an entire room of Fortuny designs that she's replicated in paper with the entire sort of set design, the theatrical production. You all know Chanel. Chanel certainly takes credit for making clothes comfortable for women, although Poiré also took that credit. These are all three modeled by Coco Chanel herself. And she certainly began pantsuits for women, although Yves Saint Laurent was the one that actually made it acceptable for you and I to wear them in public, to wear them in business, to wear tuxedos and so in the evening. And Jean Lanvin. Jean Lanvin is put in here as a reminder for me to tell you all about the fact that haute couture is big business, and it always has been. These designs, these fashion shows, the perfumes, and so on, are all about selling. They're all about making money. And Jean Lanvin is one of my heroes. She started very early making clothes, but by 1925, you see, she was born in 67. By 1925, she had 23 ateliers, and she employed over 800 women to work in them. So very, very savvy businesswoman. She had departments of made-to-measure clothes. Haute couture is made-to-measure, not ready-to-wear. If you see it on a hanger in a store, it's not haute couture, right? Sportswear, furs, lingerie, she even went into men's fashion. But the way I know her name growing up in the 50s and 60s is that she created two perfumes that all of us high school and college girls were wearing. Mycène was introduced in 1925, and Arpège followed in 1927. They're still around, you all. So let's go back to Spain, where Balenciaga, Cristobal Balenciaga, Eiz Aguirre, was born up in a village near San Sebastian. And you can see right up here, outside of San Sebastian, which is very close to the border of France. It is a resort area. The Spanish royalty, all of the wealthy people in Spain, particularly the ones from Madrid who are not having such lovely weather, would go to San Sebastian for play, for their yachts. And also, if you know your geography of France, you'll know that Biarritz is quite close by. So it's that really nice playground for people of money. And I've circled three of the cities in Spain, San Sebastian, Madrid, and Barcelona, because he ultimately sets up in the teens and 20s three houses. But they're called the House of Eiza, E-I-S-A, which are the first two syllables of his mother's maiden name. So with that, I found some pictures of the town in which he was born today, Getaria, and again, his dates, just so you can see. His father, they say in some books, was a sailor. That's somewhat of a glorification. His father had a boat, and one of the occupations was to ferry the rich people from land to their yachts back and forth, because there was an enormous boardwalk in San Sebastian that had incredible shops, and you all can pretend like you're in a Merchant Ivory film and walk up and down this boardwalk in the late 19th and the early 20th century. And then I did find a picture of San Sebastian in that same beach today. His father certainly made acquaintances with the nobility and the aristocracy and so on as he was ferrying them back and forth, but he unfortunately died at a very early age. That meant that Balenciaga's mother had to take in sewing, and so Balenciaga and his two sisters learned how to sew very young. Taking in sewing, and by that his terms, is that she sewed for these wealthy, wealthy people. So he learned how to do it. And by the age of 12, he was recognized by one of the aristocrats. Her name was Casa de la Torres, and she actually funded the possibility for him to work with a tailor. So he started tailoring, learning about tailoring, in his teenage years. And this is going to be really important to Balenciaga, because frankly, that's what we recognize Balenciaga's styles for, is his impeccable tailoring. The man could cut, he could sew, he could fit, and he could finish. That is more than any other couturier we talk about. Chanel didn't do all of them. Dior didn't do all. Yves Saint Laurent couldn't do them all. Balenciaga was the master of us all, and that's the reason why. Here's Madrid in the 20s. He had, as I mentioned, three houses by then, the houses Aisa, in Madrid, Barcelona, and San Sebastian, and his house was right down that street. Unfortunately, there's no pictures. And as I said, unfortunately, I can't find any examples of the clothing. If you all know of any, please let me know, and I'll add them to my lecture. I have about 17 of these to give, so some other people would profit by your knowledge, and that would be great. So he is a very successful couturier in the 20s, you know, in his own 20s, add five, and into the 30s. His name is known, but politics always have a way of interfering, and the Spanish Civil War interferes in 1936 to 1939. And what is happening then is that many of the aristocrats and many artists, I'm showing you a Picasso down there on the bottom, fled Spain for Paris and set up their workshops, their studios, and so on. Now, Picasso was really poor at this time. Balenciaga was not. And he did have investors who were fellow Spaniards who all became Spanish expatriates in Paris. I mentioned the Guernica down on the bottom because perhaps you all have been reading. The Fine Arts Museums is really proud to present a Picasso exhibition starting in June that is from the Musée Picasso in Paris. They're remodeling, and they're lending us over 100 works, including sculpture and drawing. So we're very excited about that. But as you all know, when there is a civil war, there's not much market for high fashion clothes. However, he was known, and when he went to Paris, he certainly set up very quickly and became a success within a year or two. And these are the two dresses that were done in the late 30s. I can only assume they were done in Paris, but don't take my word for it because I have no way of really knowing. By 1939, here are two of the models. These are from Paris. The lady on the left, by the way, was a Hollywood movie star. I wasn't familiar with her name. She was known as the Blonde. And the lady on the right, Colette, is not our famous writer Colette, but his house model. In those days, they didn't have the big superstar models like we have today with the big catwalks and so on. You had to go to the salon of the couturier, and they had house models. And this was his favorite model. You see her in lots of photographs with the early Balenciaga examples. And in Paris, he moved to a very appropriate neighborhood. He set up shop at number 10, Georges Sank, which was right in the George V. It's the big boulevard in Paris where they had other couturier houses at the time, including Elsa Schiaparelli was there. So the people who were shopping at this level would certainly be in the neighborhood. He did take Paris by storm. This is 1939. Remember, he moved there in 37 or 38. By the way, there's not a whole lot of writing on Balenciaga. More is occurring now because of these exhibitions. But I found four books, and I bought four books, and they don't all agree with each other. So 37, 38, 39, late 30s. And he is creating something that he called the Infanta dress, which, of course, is the Spanish Infanta, the Spanish royalty. And here is the example of the dress itself. This is in the exhibition. It's the earliest work that's in the show, 1939. And already the fashion magazines were picking him up and putting him on the cover. And there's another example of the Infanta collection. Well, he gets to Paris, he gets set up, and you know what happens in the early 40s in Paris. It's occupation. And so the Nazis move in. Many couturiers went out of business. I understand he closed down for a while, but he did reopen during the war. One of the things the Nazis wanted the couturiers, the fashion houses, to do was to move to Berlin. And that didn't go over well at all, and of course it didn't happen. But here, and I want to go back. Well, I don't have to go back. Anyway, you see literally the soldiers occupying Paris. I was particularly excited to find this picture. Look at this wonderful woman proudly wearing her Star of David. It says Jude. But also I want you to notice what the women are wearing in Paris during World War II because of the silhouette. They're very sharp shoulders, nipped in waists. The skirts were right about the knee level, and there were all kinds of proscriptions against how much fabric you could use. And I read in one book that it was, and this is not about Balenciaga, this is in general, that you were only allowed to use 2 yards of material to make a complete suit. And many women would take men's suits, their husband's suits, and take them down and use the fabric and that sort of thing. It was very hard during the war. I'm sure you all have read that history. So here's the one gown I could find made during World War II that is so defined, done sometime in the early 40s. And you'll notice that it has that hint of the Infanta dress, the creamy silk satin with the little beaded black puff sleeves. The only dress I could find made during World War II. After World War II, the couturiers start coming back to Paris, start reopening their houses with whatever money and investors they can gather. And one of the things they did is they agreed to set up this Théâtre de la Mode. And what the Theater of Fashion is small mannequins. Somebody told me they were 12 to 18 inches high. I have not found a dimension yet. And they're wire, as you can see. And the couturiers dress them in their styles of the day. In other words, these are absolutely legitimate designs on small scale. They created this theater, and it traveled in Europe and America after World War II as publicity, as a way to get their names back out there. This Théâtre de la Mode, in as many as are left, now lives in a museum in the state of Washington, and you all can find it on the Internet and go visit it someday. But these are Balenciagas in 1947. You'll notice the square shoulders, the waists coming in. And one of the things that I was particularly interested in is how he draws your eye to the hip area. There's always something at the hip, something which I personally don't want done. But your nice, slim ladies can wear this kind of attention to detail at the hip. Now, 1947 is a seminal year in the history of French fashion. You all have certainly heard of Christian Dior, and I suspect most of you have heard of the new look, which came out in 1947. So here's a comparison of the two suits to show you what changes Dior is making. You'll notice that the shoulders are softer and rounder, the waist is curvier, and the hips are much rounder. And if you were too slim, trust me, you would wear padding to make that work. Dior designed the garments, and then you made your body fit into them. It's very much different than Madame Gray, who draped on the body and made the garment follow the body itself. There are two different ways of thinking about designing clothes. Whereas on the right, Balenciaga, still at that year, at that time, is keeping those sharp shoulders. His suits are looking much more like World War II clothes versus Dior. The other thing that Dior did is he used lavish amounts of fabric. I know in one dress, I'm not going to give you a Dior lecture, but in one evening dress, just called the umbrella dress, because it has many folds in the skirt like an umbrella, 7 yards of material just in the skirt alone. So here we are back at the House of Balenciaga and looking at the salon in the lower left. The house models were taught not to look at the customers in the eye and not to smile, not to show teeth. And the point of that was not so much to be an elitist, but because the customers are supposed to be looking at the garments, not you and how beautiful you are. On the lower right is Balenciaga in the entrance. This place had 6 floors. The first one was the entrance. The second was the salons. Third were workshops. Fourth were workshops. 5 and 6 were administration. And here is an old photograph of him working. Perhaps you all know the word is toile, where the pattern is cut in fabric, a fabric similar to muslin, but it isn't muslin, and then he's fitting it right on her body. And this is a model. This is not a customer. I also enjoyed seeing the shelving and so on with all the fabric and rolls and bolts of fabric. He loved fabric. Again, he was not the man who would go design a design and then go find fabric for it. He loved it, and I can't talk about it without using my own hand. He wanted to touch it. He wanted to feel the drape of the fabric, how heavy it is or how light it was. Certainly influenced what the design would be. So here are some designs from 1948. You'll notice the shoulders getting a little bit softer already, but this is what you and I would call a cocktail dress. I read in one book that he invented the idea of a cocktail dress, that you didn't go from day dresses, which you and I will think look like cocktail dresses, day dresses to evening dresses, but ones like this. And it was also in 1947-48 that he introduced his first perfume. Balenciaga only did 3 perfumes. If you Google his perfumes today, you will find many more. And so you have to be careful about who designed and who approved of what. And his first one was called Le Dix, which just means the 10, which is the number of the house of Balenciaga and Georges V. The one in 48 is called the Passage of Time, Le Fuite des Heures. And the 55 one is Quadrille, you know, the dance, the quadrille. So after 55, he no longer produced perfumes himself. So if you see later ones, they may be from the house of Balenciaga, but not by Cristobal himself. This is a day dress, just to give you an idea of where we are in 1948. Beautiful clothing, beautiful drapery. Remember, he is known as a tailor. He cut it. He drapes it, he folds it, he can sew it. Now, by 1948, in the house of Balenciaga, of course, he has plenty of fabulous seamstresses, right? But nevertheless, he could do it. And he was known in his atelier that when a model walked out to go into the salon in a collection, if he saw something he didn't like, and in one case, I've got an example, he didn't like the way the sleeve was set, he yanked her out, pulled the sleeve out, and had it reset. That piece was not seen that day. So absolute perfectionist. You're also looking at the model in the fancy elevator, which was covered with red Spanish leather with those brass studs and so on. Everything was perfect that you would ride up in. And I couldn't resist showing you up close what that draping looks like. This dress was black. I apologize for the blue image, but so be it. And we all know that his client base was always wealthy. He did not have to advertise. He did not have to belong to the Chambre Syndicale, which was the business organization that the couturiers joined. It helped them market. It helped them with their fashion shows. It helped them with a lot of things. But there were really certain rules you had to follow. And one of the rules that Balenciaga balked at was that 90% of the fabric the couturier used had to be made in France. And he, no. He had other sources. I'm sure he used French ones, but he had other sources. One of the main ones that we know and identify on the labels in the show in the De Young Museum is a company called Abraham, and they were in Switzerland. And Abraham actually invented a fabric for Balenciaga. So think craftsmanship while you're enjoying these beautiful designs. This is called a feather dress. It is not. It is actually a lightweight organza that is cut to resemble feathers, and it's a wonderful combination of browns and blacks. And I always think of brown and black together as a very Spanish combination, color combination. Here's another feather dress, but as you can see, it's not feathers. It's the cut of the fabric. Draping. The weight of the fabric dictating the design. This is not a coat. If you look at it very closely, you'll see it's open on the sides. So it's basically a drape of fabric, a big wide one, which he has then taken and folded up to create the sleeves, which is then sewed down underneath where you can't see it. This, by the way, is in the exhibition. You get to admire this garment up close. And, of course, advertising. He had windows in front of his atelier, his house of Balenciaga on Georges V, but he never showed examples of the clothing in the windows. And for many years, he hired a sculptor known at the time, Jeannine Janet, to do the windows for him. And they were these really interesting sculptures. And so I found some on the internet, some of the drawings. One of them, this is wood and plaster of Paris. And here you can see a pretty bad photograph, but it gives you the idea of one of the Balenciaga models standing outside the window so you can see what the passersby saw. And then this is one of the very, very famous ones called the perfumer, for obvious reasons, because although his head is glass and his hands are glass, very interesting sculpture, the shelves are advertising the perfume that you can buy inside. This is one of my favorite garments, and I brought a show and tell, and don't laugh because this works. When you compliment somebody as a cutter, it means that they know how to see and cut the fabric so that it's going to work when it's sewn together. So I did this out of a really thin, cheap piece of plastic on purpose because I wanted it to drape for me, and I didn't have a wonderful piece of heavy silk purple velvet, right? So what I did is I took my pizza pan and I cut a big circle, and then all you do is flop it over about a third of the way down, and then you drape it like that, and you have a beautiful deep velvet, silk velvet purple coat. That's how that coat was made. Now, of course, he slipped in two sleeves, right? But that's the basic design, and that's why people get all excited and admiring of Balenciaga and his ability to cut. That's what we're talking about. Here it is with the dress underneath in a publicity shot. Well, I suspect some of you in here remember the 50s and 60s and perhaps remember that we wouldn't be caught dead going downtown San Francisco without hat and gloves, right? Well, Balenciaga did not design hats. He hired two milliners and actually gave them a whole floor of those six floors to work in and designed hats to go with the garments. Obviously, you as a customer didn't have to put the right hat with the right garment, but they certainly were seen with the right hat and the right garment in the collection shows in the salon. I was asked, did he invent the pillbox hat? Because we all think of Jackie Kennedy, and the answer is no, he did not. Pillbox shape, which is just a flat cylinder, actually is the hat that many different military groups throughout time have used as their military hats. So it's just a basic hat design. I mean, you don't get any simpler than that, right? A little cylinder that's flat. But then, of course, you get to add feathers and wonderful things to it. We do know that he was influenced by other designers, just as other designers were influenced by him, and this is one of my favorite examples. The hat, the Poiret turban on the left, is a very famous design by Poiret. And if you look Poiret up, most of his clothing for those big parties, soirees he put on are very theatrical. So this is a very common one, and of course Balenciaga obviously loved it. Haute couture presents collections, and in the early days before our later times, they would be in the houses themselves. You would have to go to the house of Dior to see his collection, or the house of Balenciaga, etc. You would go and you would find a design that you loved, or 10 designs, depending on what your shopping abilities were, and then you would buy it. Now, the way to buy it is that the models would go through and they'd have a number, and you'd say, I want number 142. And then you would go back for at least three fittings. They would take your measurements. And if you were a Balenciaga customer, a regular one, they would have your sizes on in a file box somewhere, right? They would have them there. So what you're looking at now is a dress sketch from the winter of 1957 with red and black. Oh, no, excuse me. I got the wrong one. Cerise silk taffeta with a white lace crinoline hoop petticoat. So you get to see, it's fun to see the drawings for them. It's fun to see them on the mannequins, and it's extra fun to see them on the woman who bought them. In this case, her name is Claudia de Osborne. There was a big Balenciaga show in Texas a couple of years ago. That's where I got one of my books. And this is a picture of her getting out of her limo wearing that dress. I've been asked two questions, which are on everybody's mind. One is, are they one of a kind? And the answer is no, of course not. If you can afford it, you get to buy that dress, and I get to buy that dress, but they're made for our bodies. Again, it's a very savvy business, and the managers who are working with you would certainly keep track of what parties you were going to, so you and I wouldn't go to the same party in the same dress. So they're not one of a kind. They're not a whole lot, let's face it, but not just one. And the other thing is, would they be worn more than once? And the answer is absolutely. These are works of art. They're very expensive, and you would be very proud of it and proud to be seen in it in several parties. The workshops actually made up, I've got some statistics that I like. 1954, they made 2,325 garments. Now that's made to measure. That's individual garments for private customers. And then they have about 200 wholesalers and retailers, and they have a separate show for them. And then they can buy a model, and then they can bring it back, and I'm going to use San Francisco as an example, bring it back to San Francisco, and they have bought the right to replicate it. Perhaps some of you all remember the iMagnons that was here. iMagnons had an area called the Custom Salon. It was run by Henrietta Moon, and Ms. Moon would, again, you could buy your Balenciaga replication. It would say, I don't know the difference in the labels. Yes, I do. It would say the Custom Shop iMagnon in the label. It would cost about half as much, but you still went for your three fittings, and Henrietta Moon certainly kept track so that you wouldn't go to the same party as Dee Dee Wilsey in the same dress. All right. This was designed, was in our show that we had many years ago called From the New Look to Now, French Haute Couture, 1947 to 1987. And this is one of the early cocktail dresses in that balloon hem, that, which means the hem is pulled in tighter so that it makes a balloon shape. And I love it that our curator found the sketch that Balenciaga made at a dinner party on a table napkin. And I understand he didn't draw the publicity sketches. He had somebody that would be the draftsman for the publicity sketches. And then, of course, you do a collection. You do several hundred pieces in a collection, and you have to have an inventory. And so you're getting to see some inventory on the left. These are 1957. You'll notice that the hemline is short in front, longer in back. This is the influence that the museum is calling the dance influence. And when you think of Spanish dance, what do you think of? Flamenco, right? So they've got all those wonderful ruffles inside, outside, and so on and so forth. But in the one on the left, you're actually seeing that he's got not only an inventory number and some notes, but the actual swatch of fabric that it should be made in. And, of course, if your dress is like this, and you're about my age, you might remember that you had foundation garments. Lily of France, 1954, and then an actual sketch of a foundation garment done for Balenciaga in 1950. And here I've got the 1954 stats again. Vogue magazine reported that girdles should be worn even under a bathing suit if one wanted to have the proper line. In December 1954, Lily of France advertised lingerie designed especially to fit under Dior's couture. And in America, in 1954, over 200,000 girdles were sewn. They were made of that pink Playtex synthetic rubber stuff that was actually designed for some sort of military use during World War II. And they had to be in pastel shades. Vogue also reported that if you were the owner, the manager of a lingerie store, that the stock of corsets and brassieres in a good shop included about 50 sizes, several hundred styles, by 10 to 25 different makers. A little bit different today. Thank you very much. And then you watch the silhouette change. We've been looking at those wonderful tight waists, the curvilinear waists. Yves Saint Laurent designed for Dior for quite a few years before he opened his own house in 62. And he's the one that created the trapeze look, even though it had the Dior name on it. YSL did the actual designing. Trust me, there are foundation garments under there. It's not as loose and comfortable as it looks. Balenciaga is starting to open up the back in 1961, and so many people give Yves Saint Laurent the credit for designing this loose back, but I have another answer. The sack back was very popular in the early 18th century, particularly in France. And we have this wonderful Watteau painting in the Louvre to show you the examples. You can see them over and over again if you look at 18th century French paintings. But the waist is moving away. It is very much leaving. These are called, I'm sure he didn't give them this name, they're called baby doll dresses. And you can see that the waist basically is gone. The line way down there by your thighs is really the seam to hold the beautiful ruffles. And these are the late 50s, as is this one. By 1959, he was awarded the Légion d'honneur by Paris for what his wonderful business acumen for the country of France. Three suits, 50s. Notice the shoulders are soft. The waists are curvilinear but not too tight. And the hip line, the attention to the hip line is not so obvious as it was much earlier. And the other thing that we need to remember that these wealthy clients were not 19-year-olds. They were mature women. And as such, I will stand here and admit that gravity has beat me out, right? And so he was very aware that our waists get a little bit thicker, our bellies get a little more, unless we starve ourselves to death. And so he would actually help the figure underneath by the way he measured and fitted the suit to you. And he's the one that got involved with a little bit of ease in the front for those of us who need it. So that was called the Balenciaga magic, that he would help the mature woman look as beautiful as possible. He wanted you to look good. You weren't just a hanger to hang his clothes on. 1960 and 64. By the way, on the left, that's considered a day dress. And then on the right, it's more of a cocktail dress. Notice that the little black dress never goes out of style. It isn't out of style today. And Coco Chanel invented it in the 1920s, and it has always been with us in one permutation or the other. This is unbelievable beading. And then wedding dresses, since that's very much on our mind this morning. 1960, I looked Fabiola up. She's still alive. She's in her 80s. Very, very attractive woman in her 80s with beautiful clothes. But Balenciaga designed this dress in secret for her. He made it for her himself, cut, fit, and sewed it himself in secret in his apartment in Madrid. And as you look at it, you'll see that it is a very simple style. And what makes it elegant and queenly is that this is white mink. So the white mink goes all the way down, and it's a 20-foot train. How long was Kate's today? I didn't hear that. 10. This was a 20-foot train, totally edged in the mink, and then a bit of mink here at the hip. A very, very simple gown. And one of the lines that you hear about Balenciaga over and over again is, elimination is the secret of chic. Elimination is the secret of chic. You'll notice that she has very simple earrings on. She doesn't have a necklace. Why bother competing with white mink, right? However, she got to wear her mother-in-law's that day, emerald and diamond Art Deco crown from 1925. Perhaps you heard that Kate wore Queen Elizabeth's, 18-year-old tiara that George gave her. We all know who George is now. We saw the King's Speech, right? This is our own Dodie Rosecrans, who died just in the last year. She was chairman of the board of the Fine Arts Museums, quite a socialite with homes here in Paris and so on. This is obviously influenced by an Indian sari, but there is structure in this gown. It's not loose like an Indian sari. And you'll notice it's the AESA label, so she probably bought it in Spain. This is Mrs. Grover Magnon's gown from Balenciaga. I'm Magnon. Grover Magnon went to those salon collections along with Adolf Schumann, and they would, by buying a gown or buying the ticket to get in, would therefore buy the rights to replicate it here in San Francisco. You can see how simple it is in design, but I do want you to notice the unbelievable embroidery, beading, cut work, so on and so forth. This is Jean Magnon, Mrs. Grover Magnon. And this is another gown we own, hot colors. I'll be talking about the bullfights in just a moment. Very simple. Do you notice all the time that his designs, the actual lines of the clothes are really simple? And it's the fabric, it's the attention to detail, it's the decoration, or not, as you saw in that absolutely abstract wedding gown that I showed you in the beginning, that make the dress, that make it Balenciaga. This is Yves Saint Laurent creating the pantsuit. He opened his house in 62, and he showed a tuxedo for women every collection he showed for 40 years. He closed in 2002. And this is just a reminder that by the 60s, the youth quake has taken people by storm. And frankly, we women were wearing pants. And Balenciaga was not comfortable with that. And this is 66. He closes his house in 68. But he did do a few pants. This happens to be an after-ski outfit. And this is stretched. Trust me, not polyester. He would not be caught dead using polyester. And here it is on a hanger, which doesn't look quite so good and certainly not my favorite color of green. But just to give you an idea that he did try some pants. And here is a pantsuit with a gold and a silver threaded tunic with the hat. This hat, by the way, and this outfit was owned by the Texas lady I showed you, Claudia de Osborne, and the hat she bought in 1955 and had no trouble putting it together with her pantsuit of 1967. And I think you can see why. It works just fine. That's what I meant by they don't only wear things once. Oops, excuse me. 1967, some walking shorts on the left in a black and white photo of a Navy outfit. And then on the right is, again, another very wealthy American woman named Mona Bismarck. And she shopped almost exclusively at Balenciaga's. And she had sufficient funds that she even had him design her gardening shorts, which is what you're looking at here. She was devastated when he died. Apparently, she went into seclusion for a few days. They were very, very dear friends. And again, for the mature woman, I'm the first to admit that my back is not as beautiful as it was when I was 19. And so he gives that ease, that fullness in the back for a day dress. And 67, see what I mean by simplicity? Doesn't need any ruffles. An interesting jewel right at the collarbone, and that's it. Good color combination, the red and the white. And the wedding gown with no detail whatsoever. The last collection. By the way, that wedding gown and this dress in the far back right are in the exhibition. You can see both of them. Very, very simple. And I meant to mention on the wedding gown, that is the fabric that Abraham designed, literally created for Balenciaga. It's called Gazar, G-A-Z-A-R. It is a silk fabric that has some weight to it so that it holds its shape. It doesn't seem to wrinkle much, but it does hold its shape for these unbelievable geometric sculptural designs that he's creating. And again, the far back right, a navy one, which you'll see in the show. And believe it or not, as he is retiring, he got the commission to design the uniforms for Air France. And they used them for 10 years. Very much. By the way, you won't be surprised to hear that Courage was one of his assistants and apprentices in his shop. Remember Courage that did the go-go boots and the very slim sleeveless dresses, as did Galanos. Givenchy is considered his main heir, but Givenchy never worked with him. We like to call him Balenciaga, his mentor. And if you want to remember what Givenchy's look like, think about the Audrey Hepburn movies, particularly Funny Face. And they're very much obvious that he was looking toward, admiring, worshiping Balenciaga, the master of us all. And the last wedding dress he actually came out of retirement to create in 1972 for the granddaughter of Francisco Franco. You see Generalissimo Franco right here. And again, he made it for her. Again, notice how the lines are absolutely perfectly simple. There is a seam down the middle, and there's a bit of embroidery here. She said in something that I read that he was dissatisfied with that front seam, and 2 days before the wedding, he ripped it apart and re-sewed it. She said she wasn't sure she was going to get married. So I will end this lecture in the last 10 minutes by showing you some of the examples and the influences in the De Young exhibition. There's the dates. You've got till July 4th. By the way, there's no extra surcharge for the show once you go into the De Young. It's upstairs in our textile galleries. Spanish art. Looking at Velázquez, one of the many little princess paintings he did. The Infanta Margarita. Remember the Infanta dress with the black edges? Well, there it is. And we were provided with a picture of the sewing inside, so you can see the detail work. That's all hand done, hand stitching. By the way, a couturier work, they certainly use machines. But the handwork or putting in of the zipper or those special buttonholes or the special buttons, those are all handwork. But the actual putting together of the major pieces are done by machine. More Infanta influence. Goyas, those early Goyas with those incredibly aristocratic ladies with a lot of black lace and a lot of pale pink under the black lace. Here are two Balenciagas. The one on the right is in the exhibition. And that incredible poof of lace on the top of this Goya portrait is a direct influence on the last collection. That is, by the way, Gazar, designed by Abraham. You can see that poof holds its shape. I don't know how she gets in it, and we've looked very closely. All of us docents have looked very closely for armholes, and so far we haven't found any, but they've got to be there. Religious and court life. This artist whom I just met through Balenciaga was a contemporary, a Basque painter, a contemporary of Balenciaga. So the cardinal red and the cardinal shape is reproduced. And again, think of my silly little example of cutting a circle and turning it over a third or a quarter. Or this dress. By the way, the shoppers in the back of these pictures are from I. Magnan. This is part of his retail showing. Perhaps you know our wonderful El Greco and the Legion of Honor of St. Francis. These are raincoats. And again, that one, coming right out of monks' or brothers' clothes, very, very simple. And as I said, it's just has no sleeves at all. The wedding gown. Zurbarán is one of my favorite 17th century Spanish painters, and very, very simple and sculptural, clean and clear. And this dress is in the show in pale, pale pink, and it just happens to have been donated to somebody by Ava Gardner. So this was made to measure by Ava Gardner. And it is in a case that pretty much faces you, and I invite you all to walk around the case so you can see the back. Balenciaga said, a woman should be as alluring from the back as from the front. That would do it. Spanish cathedrals, those incredibly dressed statues of saints and Marys. This is the Madonna in a major cathedral in Seville. She was paraded out during Easter week. She had a very, very special Madonna. So you just think of the elaborate lace, the gold embroidery, the beading, decorative elements on top of everything. And then you see a wedding dress by Balenciaga. And in the exhibition, we have an 18th century chasuble, or the real thing, a Spanish one with all the embroidery on it, just to show you the connections. This embroidery is not in the show, but I found a picture of it, and I found a close-up of the sleeve to talk about the embroidery. That house did not do the embroidery themselves. That's one thing they farmed out. And there are magician embroideries in Europe. And the main house is called the House of Lesage, L-E-S-A-G-E. Their big cocktail table book on the House of Lesage. And what I read, you'll notice that this is embroidery on top of embroidery. This is three-dimensional. This is a bas-relief flowers. That on this dress, there are 40 flowers, and it takes about 6 to 7 hours to embroider one. So when people complain about the cost of haute couture, this is one of the explanations. The dance, not only the ruffles and the pizzazz and the verve of the clothes, but also the polka dots. The one on the right is in the exhibition. The one on the left is a photo for publicity. The one on the right is the same gown on a mannequin. So I love to find publicity shows because it shows it moving somehow or another. Remember in those days smoking was in and fashionable? I suspect the cigarette companies also put in a little money for publicity budgets. Bullfights. He, by the way, did not like bullfights. As I understand it, he didn't go. But if you're a Spaniard and you're raised in Basque country, you're certainly aware of them. So he used the idea of the traje de luz, which is the suit of lights, from the matador, who's in the upper left. You know, matar means to kill. So the guy with the red muleta is the one that goes in for the kill, whereas the men with the pink ones are called toreadores, and they wear the bull down. They find out by making him charge which direction he pulls and that sort of thing. So we have some unbelievable Balenciaga boleros, the suits of light. The beating here is unbelievable with the pasamin tree. The colors are very Spanish, aren't they? That deep burgundy and then the hot pinks. Painting by Zuluaga again, the Basque painter. And the pom-poms on their hats, they have not only hats in this show with little pom-poms hanging, but they've got a real hat, and I forget the name of it, the bullfighter's hat, with the little bumps on either side. They've got a real one right in the hat vitrine, so you can see. They've got that one in the show. So that's right from the bullfight and the colors. And then regional dress. He's from the Basque country, and most of it's gone out now, but you can still find some areas where people are wearing native dress, regional dress. And so here is where that one is coming from. You'll notice that the person on the left is a shepherd. Lots of sheep. Basque country is sheep country and fishing country at the coast. And here I found some Basque shepherds for us from Navarre. And the coat on the lower left is in the exhibition, one of those really woolly sheep skins. And then the picture on the right is not in the exhibition, but it shows you the lining that the wool has been dyed pink. But notice it's not the curly, tight wool we think of as sheepskin, but the really long. It's cold in Basque country. It's mountainous. Regional dress with the stripes. And Harper's ad for it in 1949. The house photos are on the right. He didn't want it to look too flamenco-y, so he had the model it as a blonde and cover it with the coat, or it went with a coat and so on. But when Harper's used it for their cover, they pushed the Spanish angle and picked a brunette and so on. So I'm ending with a reminder that he was very famous. He quit when he was ahead, I guess you could say, in 1968. You see that he triumphs once again in Paris. Carmel Snow is being talked about. She's the one woman that was the main editor for Harper's Bazaar. She's the one that created the term new look, the new look, and so on and so forth. So I would like to end with Mr. Balenciaga's words himself. A fashion designer must be an architect, a sculptor, a painter, a musician, and a philosopher. Thank you all.
Frame a question from an observation.
Oh, okay.
As I see these, and the women are elegant, and they're ones I'd really like to be with. As I see the fashions today, the young women, at first the magazines show all of these wild colors and mixed up, and then there's a lot of skin, which is fine, but the elegance is gone. What's happened in the progression, or what is the view today that comes out of the past, or you see, I can't frame the question.
Yeah, no, I think I know what you're getting at, because there has been a 180-degree turn, right? Because before the 60s, if you were wealthy enough to have a Balenciaga, you had a Balenciaga. But if you weren't and you lived in Marin County like I do and went to school, we got as close as we could from pennies or wherever. But what happened in the 60s was the youth revolution, and I think we all lived through that. Many of us in this room did. And the designers started looking to youth for their impetus and their influence rather than the nobility and the wealthy. So it just turned the whole fashion on its ear. And now as we look at fashion magazines, I mean, there's nothing in fashion magazines today I want. And frankly, there's nothing in a fashion magazine today I could wear. I don't wear a size 0 or a size 2 or a size 4. And so the issue is that our whole culture has changed. And I'm looking at you. You and I are not as respected for our experience and our wisdom as the young kids are looked to for youth. And it's just our culture has really changed within our lifetime. Does that help? Does anybody want to pitch in on that? Yes, ma'am.
Two billion people, intrigued with London, and I was appreciating a lot of the different comments, and I also am in the high school classrooms in junior high, so I see this incredible contrast, but I'm very hopeful that, you know, now Princess Catherine will, you know, their life together now will really, she has this elegance, and besides being fun and adventurous, but a certain elegance, and I think that maybe she might be a role model, and maybe other people will start, you know, thinking maybe there's another way to express oneself creatively in fashion.
We'll see. I'm not young anymore, and I'm not going to go there, but I like seeing it all. I'd rather that we weren't all Balenciaga influenced or all show a lot of skin influenced. I like the whole spectrum, and I like the possibility that we can wear whatever we want. And if we want to mix up a print and a print that you and I don't like, but she does, that's fine. We're not slaves to it so much, unless you are a slave to women's wear daily or something like that. But you all know what I mean. We can wear just about anything we please today, and I find that incredibly freeing. You know, I don't have to wear foundation garment anymore. I haven't done that for 50 years. But you all know what I'm talking about, right? That we can wear what we want is kind of nice. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question about his clothes, the clothes he made. I saw the exhibit, and you brought out here today the colors that he used. Now, setting aside the reds and the pinks, he used many greens that were had a lot of yellow in them, were very bright. You commented that you mm-hmm. didn't wear one of them, yellows that were like that, a lot of brown and black combinations that are beautiful that are in the show. But those, say, the buyer was from Anglo-Saxon heritage and couldn't wear those colors. Could you pick a design and have it made in a different color than what his exhibit showed?
Yeah, it's a good question. I've asked it myself, and I haven't so far found the answer. I'm sorry. What we see in the exhibition and what we see in the books are some beautiful, intense colors. Even the pastels are intense. Even the creamy white is intense. You know, that's not a contradiction in terms. They're very intense colors. One of the things I forgot to tell you that might answer this question, he never allowed paper pattern companies to buy any of his designs. And the reason was, although I'm sure he didn't say it this way, is that he didn't know whether you were a good sewer. He didn't know what fabric you'd pick. He didn't know how you'd ruin it, right? Now, he doesn't say that, but you know that's the impetus behind this prohibition against having paper patterns. So that's sort of an answer. If he didn't allow paper patterns, which means he didn't allow you and me to pick whatever fabric we wanted, including the weight, maybe the answer is no, but I truly don't know. Well, there's some beautiful pale greens and pale pinks. Anyway, thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Would you please repeat again the playground near San Biarritz where he had an atelier, a salon, his house? You said he had three houses.
San Sebastian. It's right on the coast up there near the French border on the Atlantic.
Okay, and also, was he mainly used the pants for a après-ski? Were the ski pants attributed to Balenciaga himself? The stretch.
You mean, did he actually sew them?
With the stirrups. No, not sew, but design.
They're Balenciagas. There's a label.
I remember wearing one when I was in junior high school. Thank you.
Yeah, well, we all wore stirrup pants at one time, but Balenciaga, they have to have the label inside.
Right. Thank you very much.
There was a lady over here, I believe. Your earlier slides, the dresses, the day dresses and the cocktail dresses were all elegant. I couldn't tell what distinguishes those beautiful day dresses from the cocktail dresses. Can you tell me?
I hadn't thought about it. I mean, I read labels, right? I suspect if we really got down to it, the cocktail dresses would be dressier. They would be fancier. I'm thinking we're both thinking that beautiful black one, right, with that beautiful swath of folds across. Yeah, maybe long sleeves. I hadn't thought of it. Thank you for the question. At the moment, we're just going to have to go by labels and titles and that sort of thing. But for me, the ones I'm calling to mind, the cocktail dresses are fancier. The difference between a cocktail dress and an evening dress is length. You know, and then the evening dresses could be very, very simple, or they could be so covered with embroidery you can't find the lady inside. But it's the length. And, of course, you know when you have on a strapless gown, you have to have over-the-elbow gloves. And the day dresses, you would have short ones. So it's sort of a little bit of help. Anybody else?
My question is a follow-on, actually, from the question asked earlier. And I noticed the that very geometric wedding dress. There was a picture where I think they were side by side, actually, and one was a drawing and one, I think, was the actual dress that was made. But the sleeves are different lengths. So I was wondering if a patron could come in and say, not redesign the dress, but adjust some of the attributes.
I'm going to play it straight. I've never heard the answer to that. And knowing what a perfectionist he was and how everything had to be the way he wanted it, I don't want to go there. On the other hand, if I had $30,000 to buy a dress for Mr. Balenciaga and I wanted the sleeves here instead of there, and they were $30,000, and I thought about that. I want to bring up the cost because that's where people get unhappy. In the day, one of those fancy gowns cost as much as a British worker. Not a slave, but just a regular worker, cost as much as he would make in a year. And I got anxious about that. So I did some arithmetic, and I took a $10 an hour worker in our time, $10 an hour, multiplied it times 40 hour week times 52 weeks a year. You're not going to get a vacation, okay? And I came out to $18,000. Dresses cost $30,000 and $40,000 like that today. So there really isn't that much difference. But that doesn't answer your question. And by the way, he also invented what's called the jewel length sleeve. It's neither 3/4 nor long, and it's called jewel length for a reason. It's to show off your bracelets and your rings.
I'll take the liberty of the last question, which somewhat.
Well, there is one last lady over there.
Oh,
got her.
Oh, sorry, she's been patient. Probably, certainly.
Yes. There was a TV program before the exhibit opened up at the De Young, and I think it was Channel 5 did the program. Anyway, I thought that they said that he rarely met directly with his clients. And so I was wondering, you know, like...
Yeah, I mean, because when you go...
He was rarely seen.
But he did do the fitting, so he's got... Now, he might not have met, I don't know. He did all the fitting.
Yeah.
Even on those uniforms, he wanted to fit every single flight attendant's uniform, and they had to talk him out of it. So, because there were thousands made.
Well, maybe the dimensions and the models were made, and then he fit on. I don't know.
Means the term is made to measure.
Right.
So, if my waist is bigger than your waist, that garment is going to fit me, and it's going to fit you.
Right.
So, it's made to measure. And my arms are shorter than yours. The sleeve length's going to change.
Yeah. Actually, it was on ABC. It was Channel 7.
Yeah.
It was
I didn't see it, but
yeah, it was very good
program. One of the things I started with, I bought the 4 books I can find, and they don't agree with each other. So, all of this scholarship, he was such a private man. He allowed no interviews with the media. He didn't go to bullfights. He didn't do a lot of things that we associate him with. So I think we have to be a little careful with to say, we docents are taught to say, as some scholars say,
Yeah, they say he was charismatic, but very private.
Very private and very religious.
Thank you.
You somewhat commented, how do you see the future of haute couture over the next
decade
or so?
Yeah, I've been asked that question. The man that helped put on the New Look exhibition in the 90s said that there are very few American women that can afford it today. I heard Hamish Bowles say there's about 10, the real stuff, the big stuff, that can afford it. And so what it has become and what I see it continuing as is publicity. You know, so they put on these elaborate fashion shows. Think Christian Lacroix, which is just outrageous stuff. Normal women aren't going to buy them, and normal replicators, reproducers for the department stores, Neiman's, Nordstrom's, and so on, are not going to replicate those. They're publicity. They're marketing. But that doesn't mean the houses necessarily have to go out of business. Some are, but some aren't.
Our thanks to Julia Geis, docent lecturer at the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco.
Thank you.
It's a fascinating and beautiful talk, and I know how I'd vote on the question of, is fashion art? And we thank you for coming, and remember that the Commonwealth Club is now in its second century of enlightened discussion, and this meeting is adjourned.